True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
I remember the morning that Shirley showed up. He said, "You'll never guess who showed up on my doorstep at 5:30. And I said, "Who?" He said, "The psychotic bitch." And I told him, I said, "You know, Andrew, when I break up with somebody and put them on a plane and send them 1,300 miles away, I said, they knock on my front door, I'm going out the back door and I'm calling the police." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Andrew, I said, be serious. Nobody drives 16 hours after you've just broken up with them." I said, "Do not meet her in private." He said, "What can happen?" And he said, "I'm going to need to catch up with you and we're going to have to do some serious talking." Well, I said, "Bring some beer. I only live a block away." I said, "When do you think you'll be done?" He said, "Well, it's 4:30 now. Meeting her at 6. 7:30, I'll be at your house." Things people should know about Andrew: he was never late. And you know what? When Andrew didn't show up at 7:30, I knew something was very wrong.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Acorn TV is your home for streaming British crime dramas and mysteries. It is the only place you can catch up and stream the newest season of the UK hit series Line of Duty, a cat-and-mouse thriller from the creator of Bodyguard that takes a probing look into police corruption. Watch the first episode of Season 1 for free at acorn.tv/brewery. And start a free 30-day trial of Acorn TV with the code BREWERY, B-R-E-W-E-R-Y.
The murder of Andrew Bagby was an event of terrible shock and grief for the loved ones that he left behind, especially his mother and father. Andrew was David and Kate Bagby's only child. He was well-liked with a promising future as a family physician. In 1999, Andrew began dating medical intern Shirley Turner. When he tried to end things with Shirley, she responded badly. Andrew believed he had ended the relationship for good in November of 2001, but Shirley phoned him obsessively, and she drove 16 hours to show up unannounced at his door. Andrew agreed to meet her after work on November 5th, 2001. The following day, his body was found face down in a parking lot. He had been shot 5 times. There was strong evidence against Shirley in Andrew's murder. But David and Kate Bagby's nightmare, which had begun with the murder of their son, would end with the death of their 1-year-old grandson, Zachary. To add to their misery, it was clear to them that Zachary's death was preventable. Zachary was in his mother's care when he shouldn't have been. Why did the Newfoundland social service system allow this tragedy to happen? Come join us at the quiet end today for this tragic story of two cold-blooded murders, one entirely preventable, in a failure to protect. The story of Andrew Bagby and Zachary Turner.
Okay, so Andrew was a family practice resident in a program in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, where he was killed. So we have a Pennsylvania beer. This is Java Cask from Victory Brewing Company. And guess what? It's an imperial stout.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
So this beer is a really nice beer. It's kind of boozy, but that doesn't detract from it.
I think, you know, to be honest, we need something boozy with this case, because this case makes me cry. It's very heartbreaking.
It is. I'm hoping I'll get through it.
You won't, but that's okay. We've got tissues on hand.
So the beer, Java Cask, is a black beer, little tiny tan head, that lasted for a good length of time. Nice aroma, mocha, coffee, oak, and vanilla. And pretty boozy. And the taste followed the nose. It's a milk chocolatey, coffee, oaky, and bourbon taste. This is a sipping beer. It's got an ABV of 14%.
Very high.
And it's pretty boozy. So it's probably something you'd go slow with anyway. But nice beer.
Okay. Well, let's go on down to the quiet end. We've got a few friends there we can share it with.
We do. We probably need a room full of people to share it with.
All right. Well, let's open it up anyway.
Okay.
All All right, Dick, why don't you go ahead and start our story as we start to sip this boozy beer?
You got it. So 28-year-old Andrew Bagby had been trying for months to peacefully end his 2-year relationship with 40-year-old Shirley Turner, but she kept pushing her way back into his life. So there's a 12-year age difference in these two.
There is, yep.
On Saturday, November 3rd, 2001, over lunch at the La Trobe, Pennsylvania airport, Andrew believed he had finally convinced her that it was over, and Shirley boarded her flight home to Iowa. But the next day, Sunday, Shirley took her .22-caliber pistol and drove Interstate 80 back to La Trobe. Early Monday morning, Andrew was getting ready for work, and she showed up at his apartment. Now, he was too kind to turn her away. He led her into his apartment and then let her stay there while he walked across the street to the hospital. Now, at the 7:30 report, and that's how it works, the new people coming on, the old people going off after the night shift, there's a report.
Mm-hmm.
We've done this. You and I have both done this.
Right.
So Andrew told his supervisor at the report, and the supervisor was Dr. Simpson, about his early morning surprise visit. Guess who showed up at my doorstep this morning? Simpson knew about Andrew's difficulties trying to end things with Shirley. He voiced his concern about Shirley's obsessive behavior, but Andrew seemed to think he had things under control. Simpson told him not to meet with Shirley alone. So Andrew finished his morning rounds at the hospital, and he drove 20 miles for the afternoon shift at a satellite clinic in a neighboring town. In a quick chat later that same day, Simpson thought Andrew said that he was planning to meet Shirley after work in a bar and send her away again. Simpson offered to go with him, but again Andrew assured him everything was going to be okay. They agreed that after Andrew sent Shirley home again, he'd pick up his six-pack of beer and he would go to Simpson's apartment to hang out and talk.
Yeah, so Andrew left work a little after 5 p.m., he picked up that six-pack for Clark Simpson and himself, and he went to meet Shirley. But the meeting took place in an isolated park, not a bar, as Simpson had remembered Andrew telling him. From the parking lot of Keystone State Park, Andrew did use his cell phone to call Shirley's cell. A witness later reported seeing a single car in the parking lot at around 5:30, dark blue or black. So this description matched Andrew's black Toyota Corolla. Another witness reported walking through the parking lot a few minutes after 6 p.m. and seeing two cars there parked side by side, a small dark-colored car and an unknown color SUV. The descriptions of the vehicles were consistent, though, with Andrew's Corolla and Shirley's Toyota RAV4. Forensic analysis would later determine the sequence of gunshot wounds to Andrew's body. The first two entered the left side of his chest and his left cheek. The second exited behind his left ear. He had spun halfway around and fell on his face in the gravel, and the next two shots were aimed at his rectum, and he was shot into the buttocks. A final round was shot at point-blank range into the back of his head, and this one was close enough that it singed his hair.
So this already sounds like a rage killing.
It sure does, doesn't it? It's an overkill.
Two shots in the butt and one in the back of the head. Wow.
Yeah, I know, it's brutal. And also he had some blunt force trauma to the back of his head. So the thinking there is that she may have kicked him in the head or something afterwards.
Yeah.
Now the same witness who reported seeing the cars parked side by side on Monday evening was out before dawn Tuesday morning, walking through the trees near that parking lot. He saw the small dark-colored car parked in the same location as the night before, but at this point the SUV was gone. He shined a flashlight at the car but saw nothing unusual, so he continued on his morning walk. Then, just before 6 a.m., a man looking for cans in the park dumpster found Andrew's body. He was covered in a thin layer of early morning frost. He was face down on the gravel, and there was a pool of blood. So, horrible crime, and at this point I'd like to go over Andrew's family and his history a little bit.
Andrew's parents are David and Kate Bagby. David met his future wife, Kate, in October of 1967 in Long Beach, California. He was about to be discharged from the Navy, Kate had already decided against marriage before she moved to California from her native England. Kate's plan was to travel around the world, working as a nurse, and ending up as a midwife somewhere in Devon County in southwest England. But after a blind double date at Disneyland, they were inseparable. In just 4 months, David had proposed, Kate accepted, and 3 weeks after the acceptance, they were married.
So they knew.
They must have known.
When you know, you know. It's like a good melon.
Oh, what do you do, thump on it?
You can tell by smelling it and feeling it.
Oh, okay. So David completed his engineering degree, and then they tried to get pregnant. Nothing happened for about a year, so Kate started taking fertility medication. This apparently worked because a year later, in 1973, Kate was pregnant with Andrew.
Yeah, and Andrew David Bagby was born by C-section. He was a bright, healthy baby. He became a decent student from kindergarten through college, and he was an Eagle Scout by age 16. So that's an accomplishment. I just briefly looked into that, and there's a lot you have to do to become an Eagle Scout.
Well, it's the final rank.
The highest, yeah.
The highest, and it's tough to achieve.
Sure.
I mean, most people in Scouts don't get that far.
No.
It's a special honor.
Absolutely.
To be able to do it.
Now, he did have a temper as a kid, his parents would say, but he grew up to be quite easygoing, and he wanted to be a doctor. After graduating with a degree in biological sciences from the University of California at Irvine, Andrew didn't get into medical school. Now, this was disappointing, of course, but he didn't give in. He got a job, and he tried again, and this time he wanted to make sure. He applied to about 60 schools. He also became engaged to a girl named Heather Arnold, but they left the wedding date open because he didn't know when or where or even if he was going to be going away to medical school. In the spring of 96, Andrew was accepted into the Memorial University of Newfoundland in St. John's, Newfoundland, Canada. And that summer, Andrew and Heather drove 4,000 miles from California to Newfoundland. Andrew did well there, and he passed his first year of med school. So things were going pretty well.
Things were going well, except in Andrew and Heather's relationship. So when he came home on break in the summer of 97, Heather and Andrew announced that their engagement was off. Andrew was heartbroken, so it appears that Heather was the one who broke it off.
Yes.
But they remained friends.
Yes, she was actually very close to his parents and lived with them for a while. So she was kind of like part of the family.
Right.
Which I think would make it even more heartbreaking if your parents love the person you're engaged to and they're already part of the family like that. That would make it really tough.
Oh, it would, wouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
So a few years later, as Andrew was beginning his last year of medical school, he began to date an older woman. This was a medical resident named Shirley Turner. And as you mentioned before, there's a 12-year age difference between the two.
Yes, yep. And she had a lot of issues.
That's so, putting it mildly.
I know, right? So let's do a little background on Shirley. Shirley Jane Turner was born in 1961 in Wichita, Kansas, and her parents separated when she was about 7 years old, and she went with her mother to live in the seaside village of Daniels Harbor, which is on the west coast of Newfoundland. She was significantly above average, though, academically. Very smart. She got 98s and 100s on her chemistry exams, and it all seemed pretty easy for her. Shirley was considering a career in nursing, but she was encouraged to become a doctor because her grades were so good. In 1981, less than a year away from earning her undergraduate degree in chemistry, Shirley's ambitions were sidetracked and she got married. But even without that degree, she was qualified as a high school chemistry teacher, so that's what she did. She and her then-husband had 2 children. They had a son in 1982 and a daughter in 1985. Then Shirley ended up getting divorced in 1988. She married her high school sweetheart, and she had a daughter with him in 1990.
So she didn't waste much time hooking up with this guy and remarrying.
Well, it kind of sounded to me like she left the first husband for the second husband.
Yeah,
as far as I could tell.
That was kind of the implication.
Yeah, I think so. But the second marriage didn't last long. It was very short. They got separated in 1991, although they didn't officially divorce until 6 years later. But right after the separation, the father took custody of their one-year-old baby. Shirley's son and older daughter from her first marriage, who were 8 and 5 by this time, did live with Shirley, at least for a while.
For a while. Because about 2 years after the separation, the older kids went to live with their father. And that's when Shirley decided to pursue a career in medicine. She easily completed her Bachelor of Science in Chemistry at Memorial University of Newfoundland. And then she was accepted into medical school, which she began in the fall of 1993. So her intelligence helped her succeed in medical school and in her family practice residency. But her confrontational personality earned her a bad reputation. The other students considered her kind of bitchy, as well as the doctors and nurses on the hospital staff.
Well, also, her romantic life continued to be unstable, and there were times when her relationships were very volatile. When Andrew went home to California in August of 1999, his mom, Kate, asked him if Shirley was his girlfriend, because he'd been seeing her. But he denied it. He explained that she was older, with 2 ex-husbands and 3 children. And she had told him she didn't want a serious relationship, and that was fine by him. He was focused on finishing his medical training and finding a residency program in surgery, which is what he first thought he wanted to do, and that was highly competitive.
Definitely.
Andrew's parents met Shirley in person in September of 1999 when she took a break from a job hunting excursion to visit with Andrew in California. He picked her up at the airport and brought her to the wedding reception of a friend. And that was the only time when Andrew and Shirley were in California together. During the Christmas break of 2000, Shirley took her 3 children to Disneyland, and she asked if she could stay with Kate and David Bagby for a couple of days, on the way there and on the way back. The Bagbys agreed, and the visit went pretty well. Then the following summer of 2001, Shirley again asked if she could stay with them for a few days. She was with a college friend named Rana, and Rana's husband Greg, and they also brought along their 5-month-old baby, Aaron. The Bagbys agreed, they're very agreeable, and they really liked Greg and Rana. They also enjoyed having the baby Aaron around, because they figured in a few years they would probably be grandparents.
Well, sure.
They figured once that Andrew got settled and got in his practice, he'd find someone and get married and have children.
Yeah, and even though Andrew said they weren't serious, he was dating her at the time.
Yes, he was.
And, you know,
he brought her to a wedding.
These are good folks, good parents. They want to welcome their son's date, girlfriend, whatever she was.
I think if she turned out to be a nice person, the age difference was probably something you could overlook. It's
just probably
that, you know, she was a bad kind of crazy, for lack of a better word. Even before we know the horrible outcomes here, we know that she had issues.
So during this last visit, the second visit, on a Sunday evening, Shirley announced, "I'd like to have another baby. I think I could do a better job as a mother now." So Ron and Kate said they were pretty surprised to hear that. She already had 3 children who didn't live with her, and she's just beginning her medical career at the age of 40. A lot of stuff going on there.
Well, it's very strange to say, "I think I could be a better mother," as if the other 3 children are just a thing of the past.
Yeah, it's like practice.
Crazy.
Now, Shirley didn't argue with them, but said that she wanted the father of her next baby to be a doctor.
Well, here's an example of why she seemed a little off, or how she seemed a little off. On Tuesday morning, September 11th, 2001, that was during the visit, Kate, David, Greg, and Rana were in front of the TV that morning, horrified by the 2 airplanes crashing into the World Trade Center. But Shirley seemed oblivious to the horror of the whole situation. She strolled into the living room, just barely glanced at the TV, and then happily talked about how happy she was that her new telephone connection at her apartment in Iowa was all set up. And the rest of them just kind of stared at her, because she seemed unable to feel any empathy. I mean, there were thousands of people dying and losing loved ones, and she just seemed totally unfazed by it, like it just didn't affect her. So I think this is a good preview into the character and the mental state of Shirley Turner. There are many examples in a book written by David Bagby, but I picked this example out because I thought it was particularly affecting.
It is, and it's quite telling about her character.
Absolutely.
So 5 weeks later, October 20th, Shirley was Andrew's date at the Pittsburgh wedding of his old friends, Carl and Marcy. Kate and David were there also, and Kate noticed that Andrew seemed slightly ill at ease during the reception. But Shirley seemed like her usual self. She was smiling and she was very affectionate with Andrew, sometimes making sexually explicit comments. But that was how Shirley always behaved.
Yeah, other friends had made comments that that was something she would do. She could be very jealous and possessive and say things inappropriately about their sex life.
Yeah, and their friends, Andrew's friends, more than commented. I mean, they said, get out of that relationship.
Yeah, they found it kind of alarming, really.
Yeah, but that's how Shirley was.
Right, right.
So maybe Andrew was just beginning to notice how she could be quite odd and unpredictable.
It might have been, because I feel like when he was up in Canada, he was lonely. He was on the rebound. He was lonely. And she was giving him attention. So I think he just got into this thing and then realized, you know, how am I going to get out of it, I guess.
Yeah, you're right.
And his parents didn't know it at the time, but by now, Andrew had been trying to end the long-distance relationship that he had with Shirley. And she was becoming more and more obsessive. There was another wedding that she wasn't invited to, and she called him obsessively throughout it, angry that she wasn't there.
Yeah. Not just a couple times.
No, 30, 40 times. Yeah. And it was only about 2 weeks after that wedding that she had gone to when Andrew was found dead. His friend Clark Simpson was aware that Shirley had been in Latrobe when he was killed and that he had planned to meet her after work. Andrew had never showed up at Clark's apartment that evening of November 5th as he said he would. Now, this was strange enough to be concerning, but then when Andrew didn't show up for work the next day, Clark knew that something was really, really wrong. As it got close to 9 a.m. that day, Andrew's colleagues were getting very nervous. Then they heard on the news that a body had been found in Keystone Park, and it was described as a man in scrubs.
Suspicious.
Well, yeah, it was just followed by dead silence, they said.
Yeah. November 6th was a Tuesday, and Andrew's body had been found earlier that morning. Kate Bagby was at work when she got a call from Shirley, a little before 9 a.m. California time. Shirley knew that Kate was at work, but she nevertheless chatted away, telling Kate that she's going home to wash her hair and tidy up before returning to the hospital clinic because she had an 11:30 appointment with a patient. Then Shirley asked Kate if she had heard from Andrew lately. Shirley proceeded to tell her that she had been home all day Monday with a migraine that had started on Sunday. Now, Kate was busy. She's trying to work and see patients, so she said goodbye and hung up. 20 minutes later, Shirley called Kate again and asked again if she had heard from Andrew. She told Kate that she had tried calling his home and cell phone with no luck. She said that she had last spoken with Andrew by telephone on Sunday and that he had sounded very happy. After a little more chit-chat, they hung up again.
But there was a third call that morning from Shirley, and she began another long conversation. This time she told Kate that the Pennsylvania State Police had called her boss looking for information on her recent whereabouts. Her boss had reported that she called in sick with a migraine on Monday, but she was back at work that day, Tuesday. Shirley asked Kate to call Andrew's hospital and have him paged because she said that she had a history with the switchboard operator. Shirley added that she had spoken with her nurse the night before, and because of her migraine, the nurse was the only person she had spoken with. So Kate thought this entire conversation was odd, but she was working. Then Shirley referred to the state police call in a way that did cause some concern. "If it's in Greensburg, it must be about Andrew, mustn't it?" she said. And then Kate became anxious. They promised to call each other if they learned anything, and then they hung up. It was about 2:30 p.m. California time, when a Sunnyvale, California police officer called Kate at work and told her to phone the coroner's office in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. What a terrifying thing to hear. And Kate put it all together, of course, police, Greensburg, Andrew, and now coroner, she felt absolutely sick. She asked if her son was dead, and the officer said that he couldn't tell her, but she had bad news. So that's very ominous.
You know what the bad news is.
Yeah, her nightmare has begun here. Kate called the number that he had given her, and it ended up being the courthouse, which was closed. In a panic, she called back the Sunnyvale police officer, and she was given a second number to Greensburg, this time for the Pennsylvania State Police Barracks. She called, she identified herself, and was connected to a sergeant who told her that Andrew was dead under suspicious circumstances. At this point, Kate just collapsed. When she gathered herself enough, she called her husband David at his office because he was at work too.
And of course, David and Kate were devastated. And that's too light a word. I mean, they were just totaled.
There's no words for it. Yeah.
All right. They were driven home by friends and they fell apart, unable to believe that their son was dead and he had been murdered. So they decided that they needed to fly to Pennsylvania and they were booked on a 10 o'clock in the evening flight. So Kate called Shirley and learned that a Pennsylvania policeman had called and told her of Andrew's death and that he had asked Shirley not to talk to the Bagbys until they had been officially notified. Shirley said she had agreed and had gone to the mall to try to forget. Shirley said that Andrew had been happy on Thursday, November 1st, when they had been to a hockey game together, before she had returned to Iowa. She didn't mention her return trip to Latrobe to see Andrew.
Well, of course not. Once David and Kate were at the state police headquarters, they were given a synopsis of what the police knew. Andrew's body had been found early Tuesday morning. He'd been shot 5 times. Nothing had been stolen, so it wasn't a robbery. He'd been shot in the face, the chest, the buttocks, and the back of the head. So whoever had killed him had been angry. This had been a crime of passion. This wasn't random. And the police already had a suspect in mind, and that was Shirley Turner.
Yeah, I mean, she didn't have a good alibi, did she?
No. Well, no, it's all found out pretty quickly.
Right.
Which makes it all the more remarkable that she wasn't in prison.
So Andrew's activity leading up to the killing was put together with interviews of anyone who had been in the vicinity of Keystone State Park, all of Andrew's associates at the hospital, and Kate and David. Shirley Turner came to the attention of police right away. Clark Simpson reported that Andrew had told him Shirley had shown up on Monday morning at his apartment after he had broken up with her and seen her off on a flight back to Iowa. So police contacted Shirley by phone at the clinic where she worked in Council Bluffs, Iowa.
Yeah, Shirley was interviewed around 2 p.m. that Tuesday, November 6th. And it really took several minutes just to get to the point because she kept moving the conversation into irrelevant, self-centered topics. She said she thought she was losing her Newfoundland accent and wondered if the detective noticed that. Her home and cell phones had different area codes, she said, because one was in Council Bluffs and the other was in Omaha. When she was finally brought back to the pertinent questions, Shirley claimed that she had last spoken to Andrew on Sunday, the 4th. This lie, which she said before she had been notified of his murder, became a real key point in the case against her. Several key statements from Shirley were noted in the remainder of this phone call. She said she was romantically involved with Andrew in a long-distance relationship. She said they loved each other, but they were open to dating other people.
Yeah, right. Back on October 20th, Shirley was in Latrobe for Andrew's friends Carl and Marcy's wedding. Then afterwards, she went home to Iowa. Then Friday, October 26th, she returned to Latrobe and stayed with Andrew for a week. Saturday, November 3rd, she returned to Iowa. Shirley said that her departure at the airport was the last time she had seen Andrew.
Shirley also referred to that last week they shared together as one of the better weeks they'd ever had. Since Saturday, she said she'd been in Council Bluffs and Omaha and gone alone to the zoo that Sunday afternoon, alone to a movie on Sunday evening as well. After that, she went home and had dinner by herself. Sunday, she said, was the last time she talked to Andrew over the phone, once in the morning and again in the afternoon. On Monday, Shirley said she was home alone all day with a migraine, sleeping most of the day. She said she called her nurse in the morning to say that she wouldn't be into work and that she was taking medication and unplugging the phone, and that if they needed to contact her, they should just leave a message on her cell phone. She called the nurse again about 10:30 in the evening to say that she was feeling better and to inquire whether she had any patients scheduled for Tuesday. Tuesday morning, she went to the car wash and the post office. She got gas, and she showed up at work for an 11:30 appointment with a patient. Shirley drove a Toyota RAV4, an SUV.
Which had been seen, or a similar car had been seen, parked next to Andrew's car.
At Keystone Park. Yes.
Now, when asked if she owned a gun, Shirley said that she owned a small hand pistol, like a .22. It was kept in a case, either in her closet or bedroom or car. A lot of different places it could be, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I would think, I'm not a gun owner, but I would think you'd want to know where your gun is.
Absolutely. I don't think you're going to be that vague about, oh, it's kind of somewhere around here. So Shirley agreed to meet with the local Council Bluffs police, give them a statement, and then turn in the gun for ballistic examination. Except 5 hours after this interview, Shirley called back to the detective to report that her gun was missing. The case, she said, was in her car, which was locked and had not been broken into, but the gun was missing. So she can't even tell a good lie.
No, not at all. This is all very shady, very suspicious from the get-go. But before having a face-to-face interview, Shirley was asked to sign a statement that waived her right to remain silent and to obtain legal counsel before talking to the police, and she did sign the waiver.
Yes, she did.
So looking back, it was October 11th, 2001, so 9 days before that wedding, when Shirley got a permit to buy a handgun. On October 16th, she purchased the handgun for protection, she said. She'd taken 3 shooting lessons from an instructor at an Omaha pistol range called the Bullet Hole. When asked if she had taken the gun with her to Latrobe to visit Andrew on Friday, October 26th, which was the week-long visit, Shirley said no. But she hypothesized about what happened to her missing gun. And her best guess was that someone stole it from her apartment or her car. So there was really no satisfactory explanation for the gun going missing. And neither her apartment nor her car had been broken into. Asked if she knew of anyone who would want to harm Andrew, she said no, that she didn't.
And then Shirley was asked if Andrew had ever tried to break off the relationship. She said, not really, and then rambled on about their occasional disagreements and how their relationship was so mature.
Yeah, not really. It's not a very definite answer.
It's a non-answer.
It really is. It's like maybe.
As the evidence would later show, Shirley was an experienced manipulator and known liar. Her handgun instructor told the police that Shirley's gun was a Phoenix Arms .22 caliber, single-action, semi-automatic. On Wednesday, November 7th, Shirley, crying and distraught, called the police back to report that she had not been truthful.
They already knew.
They knew that.
Yeah.
So she said she had not misplaced the gun, and it was not stolen. She had actually given the gun to Andrew. She added, there is a lot the police don't know about Andrew.
It's always good to blame the victim, isn't it?
Sure, whatever works.
Well, over the next few days, Shirley called some of Andrew's medical school friends and talked about Andrew's murder. And she gave several more variations on her gun's location. On November 9th, she said that she and Andrew had gotten back together and that she had last seen him on Monday, which was the day he was killed. And she denied giving Andrew a gun. This was after she'd already told the police that she had given Andrew her gun. So Shirley's statements progressed from, I was home with a migraine when Andrew was shot, I never took my gun to Pennsylvania, and I will turn my gun over to the police for ballistic examination, to, my gun is missing, to, I gave my gun to Andrew, and now to, I did not give my gun to Andrew. And finally, she said, I took my gun to Pennsylvania and I gave it to Andrew in the park the night he was killed. So now she's placing herself at the park.
She is. And not that they needed it, but there's all sorts of red flags here. How many times is she going to change her story?
Yeah. Oh, I know. It's really obvious.
Now, she also said, she further said that Andrew had called her and asked her to bring him the gun. He offered to buy her a plane ticket, but since the gun couldn't be taken on a plane, she took it to him by car. She said she made the drive in 12 hours, got there in the morning, but didn't give him the gun right then. She said, I saw him again at lunch, and again that evening. He put the gun in a bag in the trunk of his car.
Well, despite extensive searches in the area around that parking lot, including dives into the nearby lake, the gun was never found. It could have been thrown away, actually, anywhere between Latrobe and Council Bluffs, in any body of water or even any dumpster. Andrew's parents really weren't the type to pry into Andrew's love life, and he didn't share any details, which I think is pretty normal for a guy in his 20s.
But yeah. I mean, that's on a need-to-know basis only.
Absolutely.
Right?
Of course. But in the months leading up to his murder, he had dropped some hints that his relationship with Shirley was over and that he would be happy to be done with it. Hints like, I don't expect you'll be hearing much from Shirley anymore. And why is it that some women have to make such a big deal out of breaking up? Andrew did mention how isolated that Shirley was in Iowa. She had very little social life and almost no opportunity to meet unattached men near her age. So right up until the week before he was killed, from October 26th to November 3rd, Andrew had allowed Shirley in his home and spent time with her. He didn't turn her away. On July 21st, 4 months before the murder, Andrew was the best man at his friend's wedding. At breakfast on the wedding day, Matt overheard Andrew's side of at least 5 or 6 harassing phone calls from Shirley, who was upset that she wasn't invited. And his anger grew this time with each call, and he finally did hang up on her. But then when he turned his phone on later, Shirley had done her obsessive thing, leaving a bunch of messages again.
Yeah, and then around October 23rd, 2 weeks or so before the murder, Andrew told medical school friend Ken Eckert that he and Shirley had broken up because he was losing interest in the long-distance relationship and it was going downhill. On Monday, November 5th, the day he was killed, Andrew told Clark Simpson that he had broken up with Shirley over the weekend and that he was going to meet her after work to send her on her way. So that makes at least 5 people who reported to police that Andrew wanted out of the relationship with Shirley.
Right, but Shirley told different people different stories. She said he never really tried to end it with her. She said that she'd broken up with him, and to some people she said they'd gotten back together. So definitely circumstantial and not conclusive, but there's no reasonable doubt that Andrew was dumping Shirley, providing a motive, and thereby increasing the probability that Shirley was his killer. Andrew's ex-fiancée Heather met Shirley during their 1999-2000 school year. This was Heather's first year and Andrew's 4th year in the med school. And during the last few weeks before the murder, Shirley called Heather several times, asking her advice. She told Heather that she was pregnant with Andrew's baby, and she complained that he wanted her to have an abortion. But then later she called Heather and said that she had had a miscarriage.
A concerned citizen contacted police 3 weeks after the murder, after reading Shirley's name in the media. He said that in 1999 he owned a company near Philadelphia and had employed Shirley Turner. She had left around 15 to 20 harassing and threatening voicemail messages at the company, and local police had become involved at one point. Investigators contacted the local police and the employees to get the full story.
Yeah, a Canadian man met Shirley in St. John's in 94, and they dated off and on until August 96, when he ended the relationship, and he moved on to the other side of the island of Newfoundland. Then Shirley started with phone calls, many of them, usually late at night, and at one time she whispered, "You will die." He told the police, and he tried to break it off with her 3 or 4 times, but she didn't want to take no for an answer. She also showed up at his door with no warning on several occasions, even though she lived 10 hours away by car. He moved to the Philadelphia area in 1998 to work, and Shirley continued to pursue him. Then they started occasionally dating again, but after a while he broke it off again. And when he broke up with her that time, she punched him in the face.
Tough take and rejection.
She could not deal with it at all.
So on April 7th, 1999, Shirley flew to Philadelphia from Newfoundland, rented a car, and stalked her ex-boyfriend's residence for 2 days. Shirley bought some roses, sleeping pills, anti-nausea medication, a can of potato chips, and a bottle of Pepsi. Behind the ex-boyfriend's apartment building, she used the Pepsi to wash down the potato chips and the drugs, and then she climbed the stairs to his third-floor apartment. On the way up, she repeatedly punched the stairs in front of her, cutting her knuckles and leaving a trail of blood and rose petals on the steps behind her and in the hallway outside his apartment. Pretty dramatic, huh?
She has a flair for that.
The man and his roommate came home from work to find Shirley sitting on the steps writing letters to him. Shirley wrote, "I know you don't want to see me or talk to me ever again. Believe me, all I wanted was closure, to say goodbye in person. I'm sorry if I hurt you in any way. I thought you would always be my friend. How could you be so cruel and uncaring?"
Yeah, so she did take some medication that evening, but it wasn't enough to actually put her life in danger.
Well, apparently, if she's sitting there writing notes to him.
Yeah. But the ambulance and the police were called, and she did go to the hospital. So now the police have all this information. But they have no real evidence to put Shirley in Latrobe at the time of Andrew's murder. Airline records would place her in Iowa on Saturday afternoon, and witnesses saw her there again on Tuesday morning. In between, there was no proof of where she was.
Yeah, so to determine that, a search warrant was obtained for Shirley's cell phone records, requesting not only the calls that were made, but the location of her phone at the time of each call.
Yeah, telephone companies at this point could provide a list of calls to and from a particular cell phone, but locating the phone by cell tower pings would take several days for them to complete. So November 21st, Shirley's cell phone records were delivered to the police, and they showed that she had used her phone 3 times on Sunday evening as she drove towards Latrobe, twice in the Chicago area, checking voicemail, and once from somewhere near South Bend, Indiana, where she talked to Andrew for 11 minutes. Shirley's call to her nurse on Monday morning, in which she claimed to be home in bed with a migraine, actually came from the Pittsburgh area. The Monday evening call to her nurse to see if she had any Tuesday patients on the schedule came from nearby Cleveland, Ohio, when she was on her way back to Iowa. The final call of her return trip was made near Stewart, Iowa, which is about 70 miles east of where she lived in Council Bluffs. And this was a call to Andrew's phone, where she left a message, which sounded very fake, I think. She said she hadn't spoken to him in a few days and she was just checking in. It reminded me of the Scott Peterson calls to Lacey after she'd gone missing.
Oh, so she was saying, "Oh, I haven't heard from you, or I haven't talked to you."
Right, right.
Okay.
Yeah. When actually, we are pretty certain she had murdered him and was on her way back home.
Yeah, well, that's what the cell phone suggests, right?
Absolutely, it does. More than suggests.
So the records place Shirley in the vicinity of Latrobe on Monday, November 5th. Now, there are two additional circumstances that showed she was in Andrew's apartment that day. On Saturday, November 3rd, Andrew had bought a box of condoms at the Rite Aid in Latrobe. A search of Shirley's Council Bluffs apartment after the murder turned up an empty box of Trojan condoms with lot number 04214. Police investigators later found a package of condoms on the Rite Aid shelf in Latrobe with the exact same lot number.
Yeah, so how else would those or that box have gotten to Council Bluffs unless Shirley had brought it back with her?
Exactly. Then the second bit of information was that an examination of Andrew's laptop showed that it was used on Monday at around 9:50 in the morning to access Shirley's password-protected email account. She had also bid on eBay to purchase a Barbie doll for her younger daughter. And while waiting around to murder Andrew after he got off work, she went online and confirmed that she was the high bidder.
So this all seems very cold-blooded and planned out, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
This confirmation of Shirley being in the Latrobe area at the time of the murder, along with her resentment over Andrew's ending their relationship, plus the missing gun, allowed the police to get a warrant for her arrest. But Shirley flew back to Canada on November 12th, 1 week after Andrew's murder. She did have a round-trip ticket to return on November 30th. Her lawyer was able to say in his affidavit that Shirley did not flee and that she only went to Canada for emotional support, but she never did return to the U.S. By coincidence, her 18-year-old son, her oldest, was seriously injured in a car accident on the day that she arrived in Canada. So this gave her a convenient excuse to stay in Canada after her original November 30th return date, although I really don't think she was going to return.
No, she did buy a round-trip ticket. But at the same time, she was informed or knew that she was a suspect. And she probably figured out that she was going to be arrested for it.
Oh, I think so.
So let's get out of Dodge.
And later on, she'd try and act like she returned because of the car accident. But she had already flown to Canada before that happened.
Before the accident, yeah.
Right, right.
So let's take a short break here.
You can take your hair color to the next level at home for less than $25 with Madison Reed. Madison Reed gives you gorgeous, multidimensional, healthy hair with your choice of over 45 multitonal shades that have been developed by master colorists. And they really know how to blend nuances of cool, warm, light, and dark to give you a great natural-looking color. Many of our listeners have written to tell me how Madison Reed hair color has improved their lives. And I totally get it. Madison Reed delivers gray covering, natural-looking color right to my door. Now I'm free from salon visits, and I'm saving a fortune while my hair looks really good. So I'm always happy to recommend Madison Reed to our listeners. It's affordable, it's convenient, and it's very high quality. We're busy women. We deserve gorgeous professional hair color delivered to our doors on our schedule for an affordable price. Find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. True Crime Brewery listeners get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit by using our code BREWERY. That's code BREWERY at madison-reed.com.
So the police had the cell phone records on November 21st, and this placed Shirley in Pennsylvania at the time of Andrew's murder. So they did have enough evidence to get an arrest warrant. However, Shirley wasn't in the country any longer, so a warrant would only begin an extradition request. Now, this is a pretty long process and could take years.
And that's something I didn't realize before we studied this case.
Well,
is how long it can take.
I think we knew it's a lengthy process. We didn't know exactly how long. And obviously, she's going to fight extradition. I mean, it's easier if they don't fight extradition. You can just kind of send them back.
Well, yeah, but she was fighting it.
She wasn't going back because she knew what was facing her.
And I think her lawyer was delaying it. There were a lot of delay tactics.
Oh, sure.
And there was always another court date, another 4 weeks, another 6 weeks. Drove the parents absolutely crazy.
Yes, it did. David and Kate Bagby returned home to California, but they kept in touch with Pennsylvania officials, and they would return to Pennsylvania if an arrest was made. One clever thing the Bagbys tried to lure Shirley back into the U.S. was to invite her to Andrew's memorial service in California. But she didn't show. She knew what they were planning.
But I bet she was tempted because she's that kind of person that wanted to be there and play the grieving girlfriend.
She could play the grieving girlfriend and wail and gnash her teeth on the coffin and everything.
Absolutely.
But she didn't show. So at the end of November, Shirley called Kate and David to tell them that she was pregnant with Andrew's baby. They weren't sure whether or not to believe her, but they knew that it could be.
Well, yeah, because they'd been together. Pennsylvania State Police announced the arrest warrant for Shirley.
He must not have been using his Trojans back then.
Yeah, that's a good point, Dick. I didn't even think of that. Maybe she poked holes in them. Because she was not above using pregnancy in relationships. Pennsylvania State Police announced the arrest warrant for Shirley on November 29th. By December 6th, she had a Canadian attorney with experience in extradition, and she was prepared to respond when the formal request landed on December 11th. Canada had abolished the death penalty and was extremely hesitant to extradite a fugitive to face possible execution. However, Shirley was charged with one murder that was motivated by her lover's rejection, and the death penalty can't be sought in that case. I'm not sure why, because that seems like an awful crime. I mean, right. A rejection doesn't seem like any normal reaction would be murder.
No, it doesn't. But at the same time, I mean, if there is a death penalty on the table, Canada's not going to extradite.
Right. But it wasn't on the table.
Right.
Right.
But you have to promise them, actually you have to assure them that that's not a possibility. You can't sneak it in there at the end. The Royal Newfoundland Constabulary received the warrant for Shirley's arrest Wednesday, December 12, 2001, and they notified her lawyer. He in turn arranged for her to appear before Newfoundland Supreme Court Justice David Russell, and he released her.
That's just something to me, that you would release someone who is a murder suspect.
Yeah, here's someone charged first-degree murder.
In the U.S.,
in the U.S.
Yeah.
And she's released in Canada.
She's free. The transcript shows that Crown Prosecutor Mike Madden, who was representing the United States, and Shirley's lawyer, Randy Piercy, entered the courtroom with an agreement already in place. There was no dispute over whether she would be free on bail. She had to surrender her passports, remain in Newfoundland, post $75,000 in sureties, and sign in once a week at the local police station. She was not allowed to have any weapons, and she was ordered to avoid contact with a specific list of people, witnesses, related to the case, and that included the Bagbys.
Well, sure.
But a surety is a person who promises to pay if the accused fails to appear in court. But there's no actual money changing hands here. The original surety amount of $100,000 was decreased to $75,000. Two of Shirley's friends each signed for $5,000, and the remaining $65,000 was promised by Shirley's psychiatrist, Dr. John Doucette.
So, at first glance, maybe second and third glance, this is a huge ethical problem.
I would think that's inappropriate.
How can her physician post a surety for her?
I don't know what the rules are on it, but it's definitely inappropriate.
I'm just flabbergasted.
It doesn't seem right at all.
You know, the morning of December 12th, Shirley had called Dr. Doucette at his office. And she requested that he come down to the courthouse because she was about to be arrested for the murder of her boyfriend, Andrew Bagby. So Doucette went to the courthouse and later that afternoon signed the $65,000 surety for his patient, Shirley Turner. And she was then released pending a hearing on the request for her extradition to the U.S. So what we have here is this woman who's going to be arrested in the U.S. She flees to Canada. And the attempts to extradite her, that's going to take some time. In the meanwhile, she's free on not even bond. They didn't have to post this money. They just have to say, I promise to pay it.
Right.
If
she doesn't come back, right.
Yeah. So holy cow.
And this bail release was really frightening to Andrew's medical school classmates because many had witnessed how emotionally unstable she could be. They were afraid of her. 5 days after she fled to Canada, at 1:30 in the morning, November 17th, Shirley actually went to the home of Heather Arnold, Andrew's ex-fiance. Heather was aware that Shirley was the prime suspect, and she was terrified, as you can imagine, to see Shirley at her door.
No kidding. There's a knock on the door, and you open it, and there's the woman who's accused of killing your old fiance.
Yeah.
Yikes.
And Heather just stood in the doorway, preventing Shirley from getting into her house. But still, Shirley just talked to her for almost an hour, telling her she was innocent of Andrew's murder. She was saying things to her like, well, you could have done it just as easily as I could have, which was preposterous. I mean, just to be certain, they did check her whereabouts, but nobody believed that Heather would do anything like that. But she also had an alibi. But most people were aware that Shirley was capable of lying about anything and probably doing just about anything. The Bagbys weren't sure if she was really pregnant with their grandchild, but they decided that if she did end up giving birth to Andrew's baby and she went to prison, Kate and David wanted to raise the child. Andrew's child, if there was one, would be all that they had left of Andrew. And all that they had left in a lot of ways. He was their only child, so...
They have memories.
Yeah.
And photos.
Right.
So on February 5th, Shirley publicly announced her pregnancy in a press conference in St. John's, and a reporter called the Bagbys for comment. The baby would not be recognized legally as a person until it was born. As soon as the baby was born, the Bagbys' lawyer would file two applications for them with the Unified Family Court, one for a DNA test and one for custody. So if the DNA test results proved the baby was Andrew's, they would need to be in Newfoundland for the duration of the custody battle, since their physical presence would show that they sincerely wanted custody.
So it's quite amazing to me, Dick, what these people went through and what they were willing to do. I honestly don't know if I would be willing to do what they did.
I tell you, I'm not sure I would be.
Yeah. But I mean, at this point, after they lost their son, they really didn't feel like they had much to live for. The father even admitted that they were suicidal for a while.
Right.
And that was their plan.
Yeah. And he also said he would kill Shirley himself. And he didn't care what would happen to him.
Sure, yeah. So the Bagbys ended up quitting their jobs in California and moving to Newfoundland. Once Zachary was born, their grandchild, the Bagbys worked with an attorney to get visitation with him. There was no doubt that he was Andrew's child right from the beginning. I mean, he looked just like him. But DNA would confirm paternity.
Well, that's good, because looking just like him isn't proof.
It's not. But I mean, really look just like him. The shape of his head, his eyes, everything. If you see any kind of pictures of them.
Well, yeah.
I mean,
we watched that documentary.
Yes.
An excellent one.
Yes.
But he did look just exactly like Andrew.
Yeah. And meanwhile, the extradition just dragged on and on. Shirley was returned to jail for several months, and she agreed to the Bagbys having custody of Zachary while she was incarcerated. But boy, did they have to jump through a lot of hoops for this.
Oh, no kidding. The worst one was the order that they take Zachary to the prison to visit his mother.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, under the family court consent order, they were required to take Zachary to visit her once a week in prison. They had to leave St. John's early in the morning and drive 2 hours to Clarenville to the Women's Correctional Center. And once inside, they were in a small lobby with several offices on each side, and a heavy metal door on the other. The guards were polite, they said, but they did have to be searched. They also searched Zachary's diaper, toy bags, and felt through his blanket for weapons and contraband. When they were let in through the metal door in the visiting room, on the far wall there was another metal door which opened after that door was closed. And that's where Shirley was brought in. Kate and David sat on chairs at one end of the room and watched as Shirley cuddled and played with Zachary. The guard also stayed in the doorway and watched. Then they had to check into a motel, they'd have lunch, and they'd return to the prison from 2 to 4 in the afternoon for another visit, and then again from 5:30 to 7 in the evening for another visit. This was the agreement, which I think is a hell of a lot to ask of these people.
It certainly was.
And she's in prison for killing their son. It's too much. I don't know how they could stand it. Then, that's not all. The next morning, they would have to take Zachary back to the prison for another 2 hours, then two more in the afternoon, and then they'd come back the next week and start all over again.
That's right.
At the end of one visit, Shirley looked directly at David and said, "Thank you for taking such good care of Zachary." Now, he had a hard time talking to her, so he just tried to keep to the point, and he said, "We're doing this for him and for Andrew." He was civil with Shirley, but tried to keep any conversation focused on Zachary and refused to talk with her about the extradition or the murder cases, which was totally appropriate. You can't be talking about those things. And then on one visit, Shirley asked Kate if Andrew's hair had been curly and blonde like Zachary's back when he was a baby. And this was hard to take, considering that Shirley was Andrew's probable murderer, and she's trying to make chit-chat like we're just two moms, you know, talking. It takes a lot of nerve.
Doesn't it?
When the Bagbys weren't in Clarenville for visits, Shirley was also allowed a daily 10-minute call to them to check on Zachary. Kate usually talked to her, but one time Shirley asked if she could speak to David. She told him that her lawyer in Pennsylvania, Anthony Mariani, wanted to speak with the Bagbys.
So David called the district attorney in St. John's, who said there was no problem with him calling Mariani. The lawyer said that since they were cooperating so well with Shirley over Zachary's care, he wanted to know if they were interested in helping to fund a private investigator to investigate Andrew's murder. Also, he asked if they would like to help getting Shirley released on bail. It seemed that Shirley had delusions that the Bagbys' support of Zachary extended to her.
Can you believe it?
And no surprise, the lawyer's requests were declined.
Yeah, but I just wonder, what was she saying to the lawyer?
I know.
She was probably acting like, you know, there was no way she had anything to do with it, and she had a good relationship with them, and who knows? But she was definitely lying to him to get him to call and do that.
No, no kidding.
And then just before Christmas, the DNA results did confirm Andrew's paternity of Zachary.
So Shirley wrote a 6-page letter to Chief Justice Derek Green, and Green's secretary, at his instructions, responded with advice on how Shirley could get out of jail.
Seems totally inappropriate.
Doesn't it?
I think it is, yeah. So here are some key parts of the letter. Chief Justice Green, I am writing to you to express a number of concerns I have regarding my extradition case. As I write to you, I am still in custody. That is my number one concern. My family, especially my children and friends, are absolutely devastated by this. I myself am finding this whole ordeal overwhelming and very stressful. I have been incarcerated for more than 30 days, and it is very difficult to try and survive this. Have my legal rights been violated? I would closely adhere to any conditions of my bond as I did in the past. I am prepared to go to Pennsylvania and try and clear my name and fight this awful charge against me, even though many people are convinced I will not get a fair trial there. I would like to have as much time as possible with my children, especially Zachary, before I am surrendered. I desperately wish to prove my innocence, but I do realize that that may not be possible. I want to clear my name for me and especially for my children. I appreciate your attention to this matter and your consideration, past and present. If you are able to answer any of my questions, please let me know as soon as possible. Thank you, yours sincerely, Shirley J. Turner, M.D. So, throwing the little doctor thing in there.
Well, that helps.
It seemed to. It shouldn't, but it did seem to.
So Judge Green's secretary responded, Dear Dr. Turner, Chief Justice Green has asked me to acknowledge receipt of your letter dated December 20th, 2002. Upon the filing of his judgment on November 14th, Chief Justice Green ceased to have any legal authority as the trial judge with respect to your case. It is inappropriate, therefore, for him to comment on the substantive matters raised in your letter or to take any legal steps in relation to them. However, in his capacity as Chief Justice responsible for the administration of the court, he wishes me to inform you that your concerns should be addressed further with your legal aid counsel. If you are not satisfied, you could ask for a different legal aid attorney. Alternatively, you could apply for bail yourself. Chief Justice Green can advise that, generally speaking, where an individual seeks to make a bail application without assistance of counsel, a greater latitude and informality of procedure is usually allowed by courts. Then the procedural details were explained to Shirley.
Yes, I think the key thing here is the latitude that she got by writing it herself, because that's what she did. And the judge seemed to encourage her and offer expert legal advice to her, which doesn't seem appropriate at all.
Well, it's you read that letter, and he starts out by saying, I'm no longer involved. It's inappropriate for me to give you any advice.
And then gives her advice.
Then he turns around and gives her the advice.
Yeah.
The hell.
I know. So she went ahead, of course, and wrote her own bail application summarizing her case. Of course, she professed her innocence and complained about the death penalty in the U.S., wrongful convictions, and also the pretrial publicity in the U.S. around the case. So it seemed to work.
It did, because on January 8, 2003, Justice Gail Welsh presided over Shirley's bail hearing. Shirley had the burden to show that A, her appeal was not frivolous, B, if released, she would surrender herself as ordered, and C, her release would not place the public at risk. So there was no requirement in the criminal code to lock up someone committed to stand trial at a preliminary inquiry.
Yeah, but the Extradition Act states that a judge shall order the committal of a person into custody to await surrender.
Well, somehow that got ignored.
Well, this Judge Welsh was kind of unbelievable. Judge Welsh said the merits of the case had to be considered, and she was granted bail prior to the extradition hearing. So the last time the merits of the case were considered, it didn't result in Shirley Turner not receiving bail. So it was the first issuing of bail that made them think they should do it again, I guess. I mean, as a layperson, that's how I read that. Welsh said that she was ready to make a decision right there on the spot, which was weird. And based on the argument that the judge had heard and the affidavit evidence that was provided, she said she was satisfied that Dr. Turner should be granted bail. Because of the interpretation of presumption of innocent, a probable premeditated murder in Shirley's past could not be used as an indication of possible risk in the future.
Yeah, but the other part of that whole thing, the last part, her release would not place the public at risk. How do they know that? A person accused of murder,
right,
is more likely to be accused again, I guess is the best way of putting it.
Well, what were the stats on that? I know you were looking into that.
Well, there were some statistics on people that had been paroled or served their sentence for murder. And of these 11,000-something people, 35 murdered again.
Right.
Which doesn't sound too bad out of 11,000-something.
Sounds pretty bad.
But if you look at the general population, the estimate would be 2 people.
Right.
Accused of murder. So you're 17 and a half times more likely to murder someone if you've already murdered someone else.
Right. And something like 85% of people that are probable murderers awaiting trial are guilty.
Right. But nevertheless, it worked.
Well, here are some key points of Judge Welsh's written reasons that supported her decision to release Shirley. Dr. Turner provided an affidavit which amply supports the conclusion that she would comply with the order. The Crown had failed to establish that it was necessary to detain Turner in custody in the public interest. Listen to this now. As her crime, while violent, was specific in nature, regarding the public safety issue, while the offense was with which she was charged is a violent and serious one, it was not directed at the public at large.
Oh, just poor old Andrew.
What the hell does that mean?
Well, I guess it would. I would look at that and figure that she didn't walk into a mall and open fire on the crowd.
Most murderers don't. Most murderers have a person they want to kill, and they do it. And that's what she did.
Yep. Doesn't matter to the court.
And another thing was that she said there was no indication of a psychological disorder that would give concern about potential harm to the public generally. And that's not true. I mean, when we look into her history, we're going to find out that she had a big history of being unstable.
That she did. And she was on medication for some psychiatric issues.
Yes. And there were 8 people who'd had restraining orders against her.
Right.
So with this legal rationale, Zachary was sent back to live with his emotionally unstable mother, Shirley. And as you can imagine, this was really horrific for the Bagbys.
Oh, can only imagine. In order to avoid contact with Shirley, the Bagbys agreed to pass Zachary through a third party, both when they picked him up and when they dropped him off. Shirley called them several times to babysit Zachary for her, and they always happily agreed, gave them more time with their grandson.
Right, exactly. When negotiations were completed on the new consent order, it was a big improvement over the conditions before when Shirley was in jail. The Bagbys had 6 visits with Zachary every 2 weeks, including 1 overnight, a total of 37 hours unsupervised. Also, they were made the first choice for babysitting if Shirley found a job. Nobody was allowed to remove Zachary from Newfoundland. If Shirley went back to jail, the Bagbys would again have him full-time and again accommodate the visits with Shirley in prison.
You know, this agreement was the legal basis for the next 6 months of the Bagbys' relationship with Zachary and Shirley.
Yeah, but it was difficult to have a third party because they wouldn't get many visits with him.
Right.
So they ended up having interactions with Shirley. And here's the part where I don't think I could do it. I just don't know.
I wouldn't even be able to look at this woman.
I know, right?
But they did that because they loved Zachary more than they hated Shirley. And that's according to David.
Right. And I can see that, but that is so selfless to be able to do that.
Yeah, again, I couldn't.
No, it's hard to imagine. Cooperation between Shirley, Kate, and David grew along with this increased contact, and they really played the game of being nice with Shirley for Zachary's sake. But geez, this couldn't have been easy.
I don't think it could have been.
No, because Shirley would just try and act like everything was hunky-dory.
Yeah.
She wanted them to go to therapy with her, and that's where they drew the line. They couldn't do it. And I totally understand that. She's trying to act like she's just another innocent person in this, when she's the person who killed their son.
Right.
Unbelievable.
I know. So Shirley started a new relationship with a man, and this lasted 2 or 3 dates before it began to fall apart. The guy's friends told him who Shirley was. Then he read some articles about Andrew's murder. That would give you pause, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So this guy told her he wanted to end the relationship, to just be friends from that point on. And her rejection response was just as dysfunctional as it always was. When the man answered his phone, Shirley told him that she only wanted to talk and apologized for calling so much, but then she continued to harass and call him. After about a week of this, the man called the police to ask if anything could be done. He was told that because Shirley wasn't threatening him, there was nothing he could do. After that, he was harsh with Shirley, telling her, "Fuck off calling me." Then Shirley told him she was pregnant with his baby, calling him an immature asshole and demanding that he help her out with the baby. Then she told him she had an appointment for an abortion, then left a message that she'd canceled the appointment. And later on, she left a message saying she'd had a miscarriage. The day after that, she called again and said it hadn't been a miscarriage, only spotting, and she was so happy to be pregnant.
3 different tales. So Shirley said she wanted to meet with him to talk about the abortion, but he refused to meet with her. He told her that they could deal with the pregnancy through lawyers, and he refused to have any more direct contact. So Shirley assured her ex-boyfriend that she was innocent of Andrew's murder. She also said that Andrew had been obsessed with her, calling her all the time and wanting to see her, but she had only considered him a friend. Now, I can't imagine her telling him this stuff to this guy who's been on the receiving end of all this stuff.
Right, right.
And he's going to believe that.
Well, the really sad thing about this is that Andrew was just too damn nice, right? He met with her, he let her in his house. If he hadn't been so nice to her, if he'd been a little more careful, not to blame it on him in any way, but I just think he was too nice to be an asshole to her and to tell her to fuck off.
No, he was trying to be a nice guy.
He's trying to let her down easy.
Yeah.
So it's just really terribly sad. So Sunday, August 17th, 2003, in the afternoon is when Shirley picked up 30 Ativan tablets at a pharmacy using a prescription written on July 15th by her psychiatrist, Dr. John Doucette, the one who had signed the surety for $65,000 for her. She spent the rest of that day at her apartment writing letters. At 11:38 p.m., she called a friend from her apartment, and she left a message stating that she was at her ex-boyfriend's house with Zachary, and they would be spending the night there because they were working things out and talking. Now, this was a little ways after his birthday party, which had been in July, right?
Yeah, he was a year old in July.
And there'd been kind of an incident there.
Well, not so much an incident, although Shirley got upset because Zachary obviously preferred Kate to her. He went and looked to Kate for comfort, for love, affection.
Because she was affectionate.
Right. And the inference that I get is that Shirley is not much of a mother and didn't actually know how to mother.
Mm-hmm.
So the baby Zachary preferred hanging out with grandma.
Right. And Shirley would see that as a rejection. And we know how Shirley takes rejection.
Right.
And I think that's part of this whole horrible ending.
I think it is. It was a month before shit really hit the fan.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that Shirley noticed.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she had walked out a few times saying, "He likes you better. Why don't you just keep him?"
Right.
Which is so immature and horrible. We're talking about an infant here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So shortly after making the call saying that she and Zachary were staying with her boyfriend, Shirley strapped Zachary into his car seat in her adult son's car. About 12:45 a.m. Monday, August 18th, early that next morning, she stopped at a nursing home and asked directions to Jobs Road off Fagans Road, telling a home care worker there that she was looking for her ex-boyfriend's house. The worker gave her directions, and the worker said that she noticed that Shirley kept looking behind her while she was talking with her, and the woman did see a car seat in the back seat of the car. Shirley's ex-boyfriend worked for an ambulance service a short distance from his house on Jobs Road, so she stuffed a photograph of herself between the rear door and the door frame of an ambulance located in the ambulance service's parking lot. She placed a used tampon in two photographs, one of herself in bra and panties, and one of herself and Zachary under his car, which was parked in his driveway. Then she ran her son's car into a ditch a short distance from her ex-boyfriend's house. She attempted to get the car out of the ditch, but she couldn't. She fed Zachary some of these Ativan tablets, probably with his baby formula. Carrying Zachary, she walked north along a footpath to the coastal road, which was separated from the water by a rocky beach, and she followed the road to the Fox Trap Marina.
So a security guard at the marina thought he heard a baby crying around 2:30 or 3 in the morning. He did see one person, short-statured, who was walking near the picnic tables. He called out, "Is anyone there?" Got no answer. He then saw the person walk away in the dark. So from the end of the main wharf of the Foxtrot Marina, around 3 in the morning, Shirley Turner, holding her 13-month-old son Zachary, jumped into the North Atlantic Ocean and drowned, both of them. So she murdered him and killed herself.
So this is a tragedy that should never have happened.
Never, ever. The findings of the inquiry into the suicide murder determined that the tragic death of baby Zachary could have been prevented, and the authorities had been too concerned with presuming the innocence of Shirley, the probable first-degree murderer. No consideration had been given to the child's welfare.
And not only Zachary here, but her older kids.
Right.
Because two of them had lived with her off and on.
Coroner Peter Markstein commented, "Nowhere did I find any ongoing assessment of the safety needs of any of Shirley's children."
Well, that ruling by Judge Gail Welsh that there was no psychological evidence to suggest Shirley was a danger was so false. During the inquiry, documents were found that revealed her history of unstable behavior. Shirley had had many failed relationships, including the two marriages. When the case was reviewed after Zachary's murder, numerous documents were found which indicated that Shirley had personal and emotional problems. And this included during her medical training. A supervisor described her as putting on a show for supervisors and that she was very confrontational, manipulative, and unwilling to address any negative evaluations, so she couldn't take any criticism.
Not at all.
Experiences with Shirley actually led to changes in how residents were evaluated after that. So that's noteworthy if you're going to change the way the system works because of someone.
Yeah.
That's significant.
There's some serious stuff going on there, right?
Yes. Judge Gail Welsh's ruling that Shirley posed no threat was founded on the premise that since Andrew Bagby was the object of her rage and he was now dead, she was no longer a danger to the community, which of course makes no sense at all. David Bagby himself pointed out the flaw in this argument. Normal, stable members of society do not plan to murder a person just because they're angry. That is not a normal person. That's not a safe person to have walking the streets.
So Darlene Neville, Newfoundland and Labrador's child and youth advocate, summed up the case by saying that two things were clear. One, Zachary Turner's death was preventable. Number two, Zachary was in his mother's care when he should not have been. So the case led to a critical overview of Newfoundland's legal and child welfare systems, as well as Canada's bail laws. A 2006 inquiry found serious shortcomings in how the province's social services system handled the case, suggesting that the judges, prosecutors, and child welfare agencies involved were more concerned with presuming Shirley's innocence than with protecting Zachary. The inquiry reached the conclusion that Zachary's death was preventable.
The death of baby Zachary left David and Kate Bagby completely devastated. And like we said, there aren't words for what it did to them. Just after what happened to Andrew and then this, it's just amazing to me that they're still standing.
Yeah, I don't know how it could go on.
After this loss, coming so soon after the murder of their only son, they decided that they would fight for change in the laws that had failed their grandson Zachary. As a way to help deal with the senseless deaths, they pushed for a bill to be passed, allowing bail to be refused in the case of an accusation of a serious crime, which would include murder, manslaughter, attempted murder,
aggravated assault.
Okay. When the safety of a child is involved. So just to consider the child in this circumstance, which seems like a simple thing that they should have already been doing. So Zachary's bill is what they would call it, and there were three key messages. One, the protection and safety of minors remaining in the custody of people charged with serious crimes should be considered during their bail hearings. Two, judicial decision makers must be attentive for the necessity to protect minors that remain in custody of people who are charged with serious offenses. And three, a decision to deny bail to an accused may be appropriate for the intended protection of the rights and safety of minors that are in the custody of the accused.
Reasonable suggestions, huh?
It doesn't sound like a lot to ask.
No. In 2006, a medical disciplinary tribunal ordered psychiatrist John Doucette to undergo psychiatric counseling and to pay $10,000 after he was found guilty of professional misconduct because he had posted the $65,000 bail or surety for his patient, Shirley Turner, in 2001. Doucette said that, in retrospect, he made an error in judgment. That's a major understatement.
Yes.
But he was acting out of compassion for his patient.
Well, I don't know. I think if you're a professional like that, you should know that you don't do that.
You don't.
Right. David Bagby wrote a book, and it's called Dance with the Devil. It's a memoir of murder and loss. It was released in 2007. He and his wife also participated in a documentary produced by a family friend, Kurt Kenny. The film was released in 2008. It's Dear Zachary, A Letter to a Son About His Father. It was originally intended to be a tribute to Andrew Bagby that Zachary could see when he got older and learn about his dad. They had friends and family talking about Andrew and how he was growing up and how much he meant to so many people. And then after Zachary was killed, he wasn't sure that he would ever release this movie. But it did become important for efforts to reform the bail system and, of course, the social services system. So it was a widely seen and acclaimed film.
Yes, it was. And it's not the slickest documentary.
No, it's not.
But it does stand out in how it focuses on the victims and the people who love them.
I don't think you can watch it without crying. It really is so sad. I mean, sometimes it's easy to let the victims of a crime be overlooked. And, you know, they're just plot points in the bigger story, but I really appreciate how Kurt stayed close to the people who loved Andrew and Zachary, and that there's never any question that the important part of this story is the tragedy of losing these two people, and that comes above the actions of the perpetrator. In 2009, Kurt sent out letters to every member of Parliament and offered to screen the film for them. He also asked Ottawa-based lobbyist and public relations consultant Gord McIntosh to help share the message for reform. There was a special screening in the Capitol in March of 2009, and that fall, a private member's bill was introduced. It proposed to add a clause to the criminal code to say that bail could be denied if it was deemed necessary for the protection of anyone under the age of 18. So this wasn't quite what the Bagbys had hoped for. They had wanted a blanket denial of bail for anyone accused of murder, which I think is reasonable.
I do too.
I mean, I guess this is better than nothing. But I don't that often hear of people arrested for first-degree murder getting bail.
I don't think, I shouldn't say it doesn't exist. It does exist, but I would figure it's extremely rare.
Maybe not as rare in Canada. I'm not sure. But they pressed for this bill's passage in March of 2010 before the Commons Justice and Human Rights Committee, and the bill did become law in December of 2010. So something came out of it. Something good.
Some little bit.
But there's just so much loss and sadness here.
It certainly is.
It's definitely a tragedy.
Yes.
But you know, it's not a tragedy like a flood or a tornado. It's a tragedy produced by a human being who was a danger and probably should have been found out earlier. And I guess there's not much that could be done about her murder of Andrew. But certainly, she could have been prevented from having custody of that baby and killing him.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, when all this hit the fan, the head of the Children's Services, Betty Day, resigned pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some fallout from that, wasn't there?
Yeah, yeah. Well, because when it first happened, they were trying to say, oh, we didn't do anything wrong. It's just a senseless tragedy.
Yeah, but I got it.
So at least there was some accountability. Anything else to add on this case?
No, I'm just sad.
Yeah, it's very sad. Well, thank you to Tristan Capel for writing and producing our music. And I'll just give a very short reminder here about Team Tie Grabber. It's a way for you to give some support to the podcast and get an extra episode each month. So when you join, you get login information and a link that allows you to add our members-only show to your podcast app. Then you get access to all of our past members-only episodes, which goes back to March of 2017, in addition to the new ones that we record. This month, our members-only episode was the story of Laurencia Bembedic, and in June, we're covering the story of Christopher Porco, which I think is a fascinating case. People have recommended it, and I've wanted to do it for a while.
Yeah, this is one of these middle-of-the-night murders. Porco's father was murdered, and his mother was left for dead after a brutal axe attack. Before doctors try to save his mother's life, police say she told them that her son was the one who did it, even though he was attending college 3 hours away.
Then as his mom was clinging to life, she woke up in the hospital, and she had no memory of the attack, and now believed her son was innocent of the crime. So investigators were sure, though, that Christopher Porco, the son, was the one who murdered the father and attacked her. So it's a murder that shattered the entire family. And it really shook the New York capital region. And of course, it made the national news. There was a 48 hours or a dateline on it. It's just fascinating.
It is. Very interesting case.
I can't make up my mind if the mother was protecting the son or if she really didn't remember. So that gives us a lot of room for discussion there.
It does.
Yep. So one more thing, if you have a few minutes to spare, we would greatly appreciate if you could leave a review for us on iTunes or wherever you listen to the podcast. So let's do our feedback now.
Okay, there's one voicemail from Joe.
Okay, so the voicemails have been kind of trailing off. If anyone wants to send one, we'd appreciate it.
That's right, folks. Let's pick it up here. And I would just say beforehand, the audio isn't the greatest.
Okay. We'll do the best we can with it.
But it's an interesting case.
Okay, let's listen.
Hi, Dick and Jill. This is Jo here from the UK. I'm such an avid listener of your podcast. I absolutely love it. I'm also a craft beer aficionado. And we have a lot of great craft breweries here in the UK. So when you do a few more UK crimes, you should definitely check out some of our breweries, especially here in Yorkshire, where I'm from. Some really great breweries. Just one of the things I was wondering whether you were going to cover was the a case that really sort of resonates with me because of their age and the age I was at the time that it happened, was the Peter Falconio and Joanne Lees case in Australia. This was a couple that were backpacking. They were in their early 20s. They had their entire life ahead of them. And obviously, it was, I think it's quite a famous crime. He was murdered. She escaped. And one of the things that is really sort of relevant in this day and age is how the media necessarily became sort of almost fixated on Joanne Lees as the victim rather than the actual perpetrator himself. It would be really good for you guys to look at this case, because I think it's really fascinating about how we treat victims and also how we treat women who don't necessarily fit the stereotype of women being upset. And I think, Jill, maybe that's something you would like to maybe get into. So, I love your podcast. I listen to it religiously every time it comes on. I download it, and I think you're great. And I love your beer recommendations. And hopefully I'm coming across to the States in the fall, as you call it, autumn, as we call it, potentially going to New York and Boston. And I'm hoping to sort of get some nice brew recommendations. So anything you want to tell me, Dick, that would be wonderful. Okay, thank you. Bye.
So actually, this voicemail wasn't the one that was poor audio. So
no, it sounded great. I was going to say it's fine.
It was.
It's fine. Okay.
There was another one.
Okay.
So this is an interesting case. Peter Falconio was a British tourist who disappeared in a remote part of the Stuart Highway in the Northern Territory of Australia in July of 2001. He was traveling with his girlfriend, Joanne Leese. So the case quickly attracted considerable public and legal attention, both in Australia and worldwide. He was 28 years old at the time of his disappearance. His body has never been found, so he's presumably dead. And then in December of 2005, Bradley John Murdoch was convicted of his murder and sentenced to life in prison. Now, the story that Joanne Leese told was that they were driving at night and a car pulled up alongside of them and indicated that there was something wrong with their car.
Oh.
So they pulled over and the boyfriend got out of the car to see what was going on. The girlfriend, Joanne, remained in the car and heard a gunshot. And then the person was at the door, basically carjacked her.
Wow.
And off they went. She somehow escaped. And there we are. Now, there's some discrepancies in her story, at least from what I was reading in the cursory exam I did. It's not at all positive that they got the right guy.
Really?
But it's interesting. So I think I would look at that.
Well, it sounded like from what Joe said is that they kind of judged this woman on her emotional reaction.
Right.
Which I always find that a compelling discussion.
Don't you?
Yes. Yes.
Well, you know how you women are, right?
Right.
So, and Joe, if you're coming to the States in New York, a couple breweries that I enjoy are Single Cut and Greenpoint. Those are both in the city,
mm-hmm.
Not Manhattan, but in one of the
boroughs.
Then in Massachusetts, which I'm a little more familiar with.
Sure.
My favorite breweries there are, and they're all pretty close to Boston, are Night Shift.
I love Night Shift. They're the best sours.
And Treehouse and Trillium. That's not by any means an exhaustive list. It's off the top of my head. So have fun.
Absolutely. I mean, there's plenty of beer in Boston, that's for sure.
And New York.
So we have a couple of emails. And the first one looks like it's a social media message, Sweet Talks, case suggestion. It's short and to the point. You guys should do a show on Anatoly. Am I pronouncing that wrong? Yeah, no. Anatoly Moskvin. So you look that up. What do we know about that?
Well, I'm not sure this, it's fascinating, but I'm not sure it's a case we're going to do. But I just wanted to go through it.
We can always chat about it for a few minutes. That's fun.
Anatoly Yurevich Moskvin is a Russian academic and linguist from Nizhny Novgorod, Russia. Now, he was arrested in 2011 after the mummified bodies of 26 girls between the age of 3 and 15.
Oh my God.
Were discovered in his apartment. So it turns out that he would exhume bodies from local graveyards, then he would mummify the bodies and dress them and pose them around his home.
This sounds like a bad movie.
Doesn't it? Now here's the amazing thing.
Uh-huh.
He lived with his parents.
Yikes.
And they had seen the mummies, but they just thought they were big dolls.
But why would a grown man have big dolls?
I don't know.
It's awful. Okay.
So he had a psychiatric evaluation.
I hope so.
And he was determined to be a paranoid schizophrenic. And he was sentenced to court-ordered psychiatric evaluation, and he's been in prison, well, in a psychiatric hospital since 2012.
So there's no violence here. There's no, he didn't kill anyone.
He did not kill anyone.
He's very warped.
He merely dug up bodies and arranged them.
Wow.
And his parents had no clue.
That's horrific. That is really horrific.
So that was pretty interesting.
That's an interesting email, yeah. Okay, we also have a case suggestion from Karen.
Yeah, this is a regulation email.
Okay, and Karen wrote, I live in Las Vegas, so there are several cases I could suggest, but there is one name that can actually be associated with more than one case. That name is Benny Binion.
Yeah, and this is three cases. So this is like a trifecta.
Okay. Benny came to Las Vegas in the 1940s from Texas, where he had already admitted to one murder and was a suspect in several others. And he opened the Horseshoe Casino, home of the World Series of Poker. A cab driver by the name of Marvin Shoemate came up with a get-rich-quick scheme, which involved kidnapping Benny's son, Ted Binion. Benny got wind of Marvin's plan, and not long after, Marvin's body was found on a mountaintop, with a shotgun blast to the chest and a single bullet to the head. No one was ever charged, but the police thought that the evidence pointed to Benny as ordering the hit. Next is the murder of Bill Coulthard, who was an FBI agent, attorney, and businessman that was killed by a powerful car bomb that set several cars on fire and blew a hole in the parking garage cement floor. Bill, along with some other businessmen, owned the land that Benny's Horseshoe Casino sat on. The lease was about to be up, and Bill had said that he would not renew it. That meant that Benny would lose his prized casino. Again, the FBI thought that Benny had ordered the hit, especially when soon after Bill's murder, the remaining landlords signed a 100-year lease deal with Binion, and he got to keep his casino. No one was ever arrested, and that case remains open to this day. The final case is the death of Ted Binion, Benny's son, under suspicious circumstances. His girlfriend Sandra Murphy and his friend Rick Tabish were eventually charged, convicted, and then acquitted. This case has it all. Sex, drugs, betrayal, $6 million in buried treasure, and old Las Vegas history. There's too much for me to get into, so you'll have to check it out. Wow. Well, thanks, Karen. That sounds...
Isn't it? I mean,
compelling.
I knew some of this stuff. I know who Benny Binion is.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I knew about the World Series of Poker. But all this other interesting stuff.
Sounds like a Ray Donovan episode.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So there's something to look at.
I think that one is definitely something that could fill an episode. Yeah. Looks like we have one more social media case suggestion from Sarah's Cooter Smiles.
Yeah, she says, I would like to see a podcast on the Adam Walsh case and all the work John and Reva have done for missing and exploited children, all of the laws enacted because of what happened to Adam. And we've talked about doing this.
This is a case we've touched upon many times, and we would like to tackle it at some point.
We do.
Yeah, because I think, when did this happen? Was it early 80s?
70s or 80s.
It's a while ago. But yet, actually, there were a lot of changes after that. One of the most famous child abductions that I can think of.
Oh, yeah.
Overall, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I certainly think that's a good suggestion, and we will try to get to that.
We will.
Well, I hope we'll get some more voicemails next week. Don't be shy.
Yeah, speak up.
Yeah.
Hit that button or whatever it is.
Yeah. Tigrabber.com, leave a voicemail.
There you go.
There you go.
And it's easy.
It is easy.
And if you like me, you can write them out before you speak them.
I always have an outline or a script.
Yep.
Yeah, because my mind goes blank sometimes.
Well, and how do you think we do an hour and a half, 2 hour show?
I couldn't do it off the cuff.
Without having some kind of written stuff to
refer to. You have to have something to follow. So, absolutely.
We do.
Otherwise, I mean, if you can just, I was going to say freebase it.
Wing it.
You can just wing it, but then afterwards I'm going to say, shit, I missed this. I forgot that.
Exactly.
So, yeah, we're not opposed if you want to write out what you have to say and then call in your email and a voicemail would be perfect.
Perfect.
And a big thank you to everyone for listening to us, putting up with us, and we'll see you at the quiet end in another week.
You got it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.